If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, November the 2nd, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. We're doing something different today. This is a podcast not so much about the 45th president, but instead about the 31st state in the Union, which is, of course, the great state of California, which became a star on the flag in 1850. 3 months ago, the Hoover Institution launched a new webpage. It's called California on Your Mind. It's a biweekly journal devoted to California politics, California policies, and the intricacies of California's economy, which last May surpassed Great Britain as the world's fifth largest. I write for this publication every Thursday. On Mondays, you'll find a column by my Hoover colleague, Leo Hanian, who's our guest today on the show, about my friend Lee. Leo Hanian is a Hoover Senior Fellow and Professor of Economics and Director of the Edinger Family Program in Macroeconomic Research at UCLA. He's also Associate Director of the Center of the Advanced Study in Economic Efficiency at Arizona State University and a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he co-directs the research initiative Microeconomics Across Time and Space. Lee, how are you today?
Bill, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I would love to take credit for California on Your Mind, but this was your idea, so I give credit where credit is due. What prompted you, Lee, to have California on your mind?
There were really two issues. One is that just in my lifetime and having grown up in California, I saw how much the state changed because of changes in economic policies. So as a kid growing up here in the 60s and 70s, California really was the place it seemed for everyone to be. There was enormous economic growth. There was enormous population growth. This was the time of the Golden State and, you know, what the Beach Boys call California dreaming. Mm-hmm. And then I went away to school and went to graduate school and came back after several years. I moved back here about 20 years ago. And that dynamism, that sense that anything and everything was possible was gone. The business growth was much lower. Housing prices had skyrocketed. It was just a much, much different state than I remembered as a kid. And I just thought, you know, what happened to the state? And then last winter, what really pushed me over the edge to start writing about California once a week, each Tuesday on the Hoover website, was the fact that I live in Santa Barbara, and my family and I were severely affected by wildfires and debris flows. And 23 of the people in my small community died because of enormous mudslides. And I thought, you know what, this didn't have to happen. The first business of government is to protect its citizens. And public policy really just hadn't done that. And so 3 months ago, you and I started California on Your Mind, and it's been so much fun and a way to reduce my blood pressure when I get worked up about state economic policies.
So you're a California native, which makes you a rarity to begin with, but you grew up then in the idyllic California. This is the My Three Sons California, the Brady Bunch California, the California which is sunshine and very happy people living in the suburbs, and they just aren't too many problems in life other than what can be solved in a 30-minute sitcom.
That was the California I grew up in. It was affordable. The schools were great. There was never any issue about not being able to find a good paying job. There was never any issue about thinking, hey, I'll be even better off 10 years from now than I am today. It really was a place of unlimited opportunity. And I think a lot of that came from a shared vision of policymaking that government should provide the resources and the investments that are really important for people and that make people's lives better and promote economic growth. And I think California was just a remarkable, striking example of that policy vision.
Let's talk about perhaps the most idyllic of idyllic California, and that's California in the Pat Brown years. Now, this is the original Governor Brown, the original Edmund G. Brown, the original Jerry Brown, if you will, who governed from 1958 to 1966. Now, a word of caution about that, Lee. A lot of people lament, why can't we have Pat Brown's California? I'd like to point out that, you know, I think there were 15 million people in Pat Brown's California. It's not the 40 million nation state that we are today. But there are some important things about how Governor Brown governed and how he did his budget that are worth pointing out.
Oh, absolutely. I've written quite a bit about Pat Brown and juxtaposed how Pat Brown governed with his son Jerry Brown version 2.0 today. And it's hard to find a more extreme difference between two governors. So on the day of Pat Brown, the state faced really enormous, despite the fact that we were growing so quickly, the state faced enormous economic challenges. About half of the state's population during the Pat Brown period, about half the state's population was under the age of 24. So mm-hmm. these were people that did not generate a lot in the way of tax revenue for the state to use, but they required a lot of public services such as schooling. And the state found a way to allocate the budget so that we made these capital investments. 20% of the budget during the Pat Brown years was devoted to capital investments such as building schools and roads and bridges and water conveyance and water storage. That 20% of investment that occurred under Pat Brown's term, that's not 2% today under Jerry Brown's California. So it's just remarkably different, two remarkably different periods. And we're paying the price in California now because we don't make the necessary investments.
Right. Two other differences between then and now, Lee. One is the rich poor divide, depending on how you measure poverty, up to what California is, by most measures, the poorest state in the nation, in addition to being the wealthiest, a poverty rate approaching some studies of 20%. But also the number of Californians, Lee, who are tied into government now through health care, which I think is something like 10 to 12 to 13 million people, if I'm not mistaken. This is Medi-Cal and Obamacare. And that wasn't going on in the 1960s and 70s.
No, with the passage of Obamacare, we now have 15 million Californians on Medicaid. That would be the fifth most populous state in the country if those right. folks were by themselves. There certainly wasn't the issue of the haves and have-nots that we have today. There was widespread opportunity. There was widespread upward mobility in California. And this existed for both highly skilled people, such as individuals working in aerospace, and down to people with less education, less skill. My old landscaper was an immigrant from Mexico. He owned two apartment buildings in Santa Monica, in addition to working on the backyard of my house, my neighbor's house. California is a place where everybody could succeed if you put your mind to it. And today, there's really two Californias. There's coastal California from the Pacific Ocean in about 20 or 30 miles, where economic success is remarkable for some. And then you have the rest of California, 98% of the landmass of California, Merced, Modesto, Fresno, where median inflation-adjusted incomes are still below what they were in the early 2000s. And in my view, economic policies is a reason why so many low-skilled Californians are struggling today and don't have the types of upward mobility that everyone had 40, 50 years ago.
I know the difference between then and now, Lee. Back in the 60s, the Pat Brown era is famous for building. This is in the Brown DNA. It's how some people justify Jerry Brown's interest in doing water tunnels and high-speed rail. Pat Brown built what? He built freeways. He built the California water system going north-south. He was interested in building a university system. But you look in this day and age, Lee, and you look at the giant constructions brought on, the idea of twin water tunnels, which are hugely controversial in Sacramento, the high-speed rail project, which, my God, we can do a whole separate conversation about high-speed rail and the sense or folly of that. But it just seems that big projects in California aren't as smooth and aren't, for lack of a better word, aren't as noble as they seemed to be 50 years ago.
No. What used to get built in a day now takes a year. What used to get built in a year now takes 20 years. Building has become incredibly difficult in California. And I think there's a number of reasons why that's the case. And again, I think it's related to economic policies. We now have the California Environmental Quality Act, which has really become weaponized as a tool to stop or prevent or delay infrastructure investment. CEQA lawsuits are now routinely filed and are mostly aimed at government projects. About 80% of CEQA lawsuits are aimed at stopping or delaying government infill projects. Right. And this ranges from labor unions that want to try to leverage a development into hiring unionized labor, to businesses who think they might lose revenue if a certain project gets through. And you know, you mentioned the high speed rail, and yes, we could have one or ten discussions about that. And what's ironic about the high-speed rail is that if it was ever green-lighted and all the funding became available, and by the time it finally was built, the technology would probably be Model T. And a lot of the benefits that were ascribed to the high-speed rail, which were an important argument for trying to say the benefits of the project outweigh the costs, a big part of the benefits are people would have time available to work or to do other things while on the train. Guess what? If that project ever became feasible and was green-lighted, driverless cars would take away that benefit.
Right. Good point. You mentioned inland California versus coastal California. Now, every governor we've elected in recent history has been a coastal Californian, if you want to go by that geographical definition. Pat Brown from San Francisco, George Shipmanius from Long Beach, Sun Jerry from San Francisco, Pete Wilson from San Diego, Arnold Schwarzenegger from the Pacific Palisades, Gray Davis from Los Angeles, back to Jerry Brown now. So we've not had an inland governor, but I'm struck by the guy who's coming into office, Lee, we're doing this before the election, but by the time people listen to this, the election will be over, and the assumption is Gavin Newsom will be the next governor of California. He is coastal Californian, Lee, with an exclamation point. And I was kind of struck by this the other day. I was reading this fascinating article about Newsom in the New Yorker, and I encourage our listeners to go check it out. It's a beautiful piece of writing, and it's just a really long conversation with Newsom about himself. And the passage that stuck out to me, Lee, was they were going to his home in Marin County. It's a fabulous home up on a hill. And as they're pulling into the driveway, Newsom turns to the reporter and says, "You're going to make fun of the fact that I have a Tesla." And the reporter dryly notes, "There are three Teslas sitting in the driveway." So we have a Tesla governor, for lack of a better word to affix to Governor Newsom. And here's the question, Lee. You've been looking at Gavin Newsom, and you've been looking at his economics, and he has a lot of ideas for a lot of things in California. But if you were to sit down with him and have a frank conversation about the economy and what to do, how would you steer him? Where would you take him?
So, Bill, you're absolutely right. Gavin Newsom is the coastal California governor on steroids. You couldn't find more of a poster child for that particular moniker than Gavin Newsom. Incredibly wealthy, incredibly focused on a set of policy and budget priorities that I think are diametrically opposed to the interests of the people that really, I don't think, have much of a voice in California today. All those people living in Modesto and Merced and Fresno and the Central Valley. You know, take, for example, recent legislation or recent ruling that Newsom was very happy about. Virtually every new home in California constructed beginning in 2020 must have solar panels on its roof. Mm-hmm. This will add, between the solar panels and between energy efficient windows and installation and special lighting, this will add as much as $30,000 to $40,000 to the cost of a home where we already have the second most expensive housing in the country, second only to Hawaii.
Right.
And this is really misdirected. I mean, Newsom was extremely happy about this, saying, "Oh, we're going to go even greener." We already produce so much solar energy that we pay Arizona to take the energy off of our hands so that we don't blow up the grid. If we, in the case that we wanted to produce more solar energy, we can do it on solar farms for twice the efficiency as we can do with solar panels on people's rooftops. So these are the kind of policies that California is more and more getting into, policies that really play to preferences, to social preferences of people that say, "Oh, isn't it great that California is becoming greener? I think this restriction is wonderful. We'll all be our own little solar percolator." Well, that solar power doesn't really go to your house. It goes back into the grid. So what I would recommend to Newsom is that we need to look back towards Pat Brown and look at the kinds of priorities that Pat Brown had that really mattered for and made a difference for everyone's lives in a positive way. Not policies that really punish 90 to 95% of Californians, and that give 5% of our residents a warm, fuzzy feeling that, gee, isn't it great, we're becoming even greener. Newsom absolutely has a long laundry list of priorities that he has, and they will be incredibly expensive, and if anything, they will depress economic growth. And I think really hurt many of the constituents that look to the Democratic Party for policies that will improve their lives.
Now, one of the challenges, Lee, is going to not just Governor Newsom, but the Democratic legislature and informing them that laissez-votem rouler is not going to go on forever here in California. This is a budget that's going to bring in $8 to $9 billion extra dollars in revenue, probably in the next year. But it's also an economic recovery, Lee, which is past its due date of expiring. The California economy is like a dairy product, and eventually it goes sour. Now, every May, Governor Brown, to his credit, he reveals the May revise to the budget. This is the revamped version of the budget after you get your tax revenue in April and you adjust your spending accordingly. And Brown uses the occasion every year to warn that the economy is sooner or later going to go south. And he brings out the charts and shows the history of boom and bust in California. Reporters write about it dutifully, and it's forgotten within 48 hours. But this conversation has to be had with the governor and the legislature that eventually the economy is not going to do well. It's my question for you, Lee. I worked in the governor's office a long, long time ago, and I can tell you that each year we would hold our breath when the Anderson School was coming out with its economic forecast. We viewed that the way that Wall Street views earnings from certain benchmark companies. We thought, boy, Anderson is going to tell us good times are coming or bad times are coming, and which is really kind of drive us for several weeks of conversation. You look at this economy, and what do you think is going to happen here in the next few years?
California continues to suffer from, you know, the important shortcoming that our tax base is incredibly narrow. Mm-hmm. Roughly the top 1% pay about 50% of state tax revenue. And that top 1% revenue stream is incredibly volatile. Largely because their revenue and their incomes strongly affect issues such as capital gains. When they choose to exercise those capital gains, they don't exercise those capital gains during downturns. So what we have is just enormous roller coaster revenue. We have huge drops in revenue that come during downturns. And this is exacerbated by the fact that business activity is generally declining. And when you mention that, hey, you know what, the good times in California can't roll on forever. You look at housing prices today, and it's absolutely frightening in terms of thinking about what happened in 2008. 26% of Californians can afford the median priced house, which is now about $550,000. Mm-hmm. In areas such as San Francisco and Silicon Valley, where salaries and incomes are much, much higher, the affordability issue is even worse. Only 15% of households can afford the median priced house. So 100 basis point increase in the mortgage rate and the housing market is going to come crashing down. And with that, people's wealth will decline, and that could be enough to generate California's next major recession. And all it takes is about a 1 percentage point increase in the mortgage rate. Home prices are already starting to cool off, so Newsom may be greeted with a substantially weakened economy when he takes office.
Right. Did you vote in this election?
I'm voting on Tuesday.
You're going to actually go in person and vote. Congratulations. You're one of the few and the proud who actually do this.
This is the way I've done it ever since I started voting, and it gives me a good feeling when I walk in there and then I walk out with my little I voted button.
This is a problem in California now. The state has just killed itself for the past 30 years to make it easier to vote. So now voting by mail is dominating the process here. About 2/3 of the ballots cast in this election could be vote by mail, which sounds great, except for one problem. A lot of people wait until the last 48 hours of the election to vote by mail. You can't get the ballots counted in time, and you can go weeks without getting a solution here. It's going to be a huge problem in the 2020 primary out here, Lee. But I asked about your voting in the election because you were watching the governor's race. I found the governor's race just wholly disappointing. And I'm going to go into full propeller head mode here. I would love to have seen a series of debates up and down the state between John Cox and Gavin Newsom. I would love to have seen theme debates. I would love to have seen an economic debate in San Francisco, a livability debate in Los Angeles, perhaps a values debate in the Central Valley. You take on these big issues facing California right now. The two candidates, Lee, they debated once, if you can call it a debate. It was 1 hour on public radio early in the morning in San Francisco, which guarantees nobody listened to it. They never did a televised debate, just as there was not a televised debate in the Senate election as well. And a whole series of big issues have gone unaddressed in this election, Lee. Now, the Hoover Institution stepped in the void here, and you're involved in this project I'd like you to talk about. Our fellows have put out a series of white papers about problems facing California, and our listeners can find it on the Hoover website, www.hoover.org. You'll find a paper on high energy costs. You'll find another one on underperforming schools. There's a white paper on unreliable water supplies. Another, I think Scott Atlas wrote it on healthcare cost, a piece on inadequate state capital investment, which gets back to the Pat Brown days, a piece by Josh Rao on massive unfunded pension liabilities. You wrote a piece, Lee, on housing costs. And I want to talk a bit about housing in this election, Lee, because there was a proposition on the ballot dealing specifically with housing, the price of rent, rent control, Proposition 10. And we're doing this podcast a couple days before the election, but right now it looks like it's going down in flames. Have you been following Prop 10 at all?
I have. And when you mentioned that it's going to go down in flames, I'm really happy to hear that because, virtually every economist really despises rent control because it's a measure that ends up really hurting the people that you want to help. So Prop 10 would have made it much easier for local governments to expand rent control within their districts and get past the Costa-Hawkins legislation, which was really, mandating what rent control could be in California. Some of our colleagues in Stanford Economics have just conducted, I think is one of the most interesting studies of rent control. It was done in San Francisco. And San Francisco in the early 90s designated some neighborhoods as rent controlled and then ones right across the street as not rent controlled. So they ran the experiment. And the experiment was really interesting. In 20 years, the amount of rental housing supply within San Francisco declined 25% as owners turned those into condos or took them off the market. And those who remained in those buildings, a lucky few, benefited. But future renters are going to face even higher prices because there's less rental housing available today in San Francisco. In economics, we like to say the demand curve slopes down and the supply curve slopes up. And right. That's just an immutable law you can't get around. And some people pretend that rent control will get around that, and it doesn't. So I'm glad to hear that you're out there on the front lines seeing what's going on, and I'm glad to hear that's not going to pass or looks unlikely to pass.
2016 taught me a hard lesson, Lee, which is don't get too cocky about forecasts. But I say that Prop 10 is probably going to go down for one simple reason. The proponents of Prop 10 are in the paper today saying they're going to do an initiative in 2020. So that's a pretty good tell. Things aren't going to work out in 2018. But I'm curious as to why this has not worked out, because on paper, look, this is in theory a very progressive state. It's a lot of urban hipsters, a lot of people paying a lot of money in rent. It's a very effective message. The rent's too damn high. Bernie Sanders supports Prop 10. But it's not going anywhere. Now, we can talk about the politics of ballot initiatives, and a lot of money has been thrown against this initiative. But it's interestingly, in the case of both Proposition 10, but also Proposition 6, which is the proposed repeal of last year's increase in the gasoline tax, this idea that this kind of angry vox populi would emerge at the ballot box, it appears it's not going to work out in both those cases.
That's interesting. I'd like to say that Prop 10 is not working out because voters understand the simple economics behind why Prop 10 wouldn't work out. I'd like to think that, but as you mentioned, a lot of money has been thrown at Prop 10, and turn on your favorite television channel right now, and I can almost guarantee you that within 10 minutes, you'll see a no on 10 commercial. And the economics behind what they're talking about is is spot on. Right. In case of the gas tax, you know, it's interesting. I should say, just as a sidebar, the white paper that I and some other Hoover economists wrote about California really was born out of a conversation we had with Cox's team, mm-hmm. and we thought, you know, we really should try to inform policymakers and inform voters about what some of the really challenging problems are in California, and what we think can be done relatively simply to fix those. Cox is certainly very strongly for repealing the gas tax. It's a tax that people seem to care about because the tax base there, as opposed to the income tax, is quite broad. And I'm sympathetic to Cox's point, which is, hey, in a $200 billion budget, if I have control of that and the legislature works cooperatively with me, I will find a way to fix our infrastructure without imposing additional taxes. So I can certainly see that. There's been a lot of ads against Prop 6, which is, hey, the firefighters and virtually everybody is against this repeal. Don't do it or our roads will get even worse. And I think those ads were probably quite effective.
Yeah, let me put on my strategist hat here for a second and explain why I think Prop 6 is going down. It's not unlike what Republicans have learned in talking about Obamacare, Lee, and that repeal is a very sexy word. It's a word that gets your attention. It's the kind of word you find on an Ann Coulter book, repeal. But the problem is, if you want to repeal something that has positive aspects to it, you have a problem. Republicans discovered this with Obamacare. It's great to say you're going to repeal Obamacare, but what happens when people like the idea of being able to take your pre-existing conditions and put them in your coverage? Oops, now we have a problem. So now we have to modify our message to repeal and replace. And that's been in part the lesson on Prop 6, I think. If you notice, this started as strictly repeal. Well, the pushback is this. You like construction on roads. You like infrastructure projects. So what has the Prop 6 campaign had to do? They've had to turn it into a repeal and replace conversation where, okay, we're going to repeal the gasoline tax, and then we're going to go after high-speed rail in 2020 on initiative. We'll take the money from that and put that into infrastructure. Problem solved. Very complicated for people to kind of grasp that. But the other part of the problem, Lee, with the Prop 6 campaign would be just picking on a fight with special interests. Arnold Schwarzenegger learned this lesson the hard way in 2005. He put a series of measures on the ballot, and they all were very good ideas. These were teacher tenure issues and budget reform and so forth. There was no great intellectual nexus to the ideas, and he quickly found himself in a firefight with the California Nurses Association and the California Teachers Association and California Cops and Firefighters. And he got creamed in that election, and Prop 6 is getting beat up very much for the same way. You are attacking politicians for raising the gasoline tax, but you're being pushed back by firefighters and moms who drive minivans, and in the very short attention span theater that is television ads in California, it doesn't look too good. But let's get back to housing for a second. So the Prop 10 proponents who want to take another run at this in 2020, their argument for doing that is they don't like Gavin Newsom's approach on housing. But I'm confused, Lee. I've heard Gavin Newsom talk about a Marshall Plan for housing in California, but I don't know what the Marshall Plan means. That sounds like a great idea. I imagine he'll put a lot of smart people around a table and try to solve something, but I'm not sure what he is trying to unleash on California in terms of fixing our housing problems.
So there's really two angles that I think are relevant for understanding California's housing shortage and why prices are so high. And it's interesting in that Cox is focused on one of them, which is regulatory issues that drive up the cost of housing.
Yeah.
And Newsom really is focused on the other one, one which, you know, I'll call not in my backyard. So a lot of zoning is done at the local level. There's a lot of opposition depending upon who's trying to build and depending where it's trying to be built. If you're thinking of building, you know, quote, affordable housing on the outskirts of Beverly Hills, I guarantee you there'll be an outcry of opposition to that. And local politicians will listen to that and cave and prevent that construction.
By the way, Newsom lives in Marin County, and that's exactly what's happened in Marin County. There was an effort to build affordable housing near the Lucas Ranch in Marin County, and the pushback was fierce. NIMBYism.
Absolutely. So what Newsom has suggested is that he will try to incentivize local governments by providing additional state funding if they're willing to invest in new housing. And he's also said, you know what, maybe I'll take some funding away from you if you're going to be recalcitrant and not try to follow through and build new housing. So I think the solution probably is limit the ability of local governments to appeal to various draconian zoning laws and stopping investment every time somebody says, hey, not in my backyard. And on the other hand, I think Cox is spot on that regulation drives up housing costs enormously. There was an article in San Diego Union about a week ago, which indicated that if you're building an apartment in San Diego that's going to be, quote, affordable housing, the cost is about $425,000 per unit for affordable housing for, you know, a two-bedroom apartment, which is, you know, let's face it, you ask anybody else in the country about, hey, do you think it's reasonable to build a two-bedroom apartment per unit at $425,000? I mean, they're just going to look at you like you're crazy. So I think there's no question that regulation is a big part of this as well.
So a Democratic governor of California is going to have to work with the Democratic legislature, unless you do this by the ballot box, but they're going to have to work together to get a housing solution, which means, Lee, that somebody on the left is going to have to drink some cod liver oil. So who will have to imbibe?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because it's going to be unpopular to tell for legislators to go back to their districts and say, hey, you know what, we're going to have to start building, and you may not like that. I think the third possibility, which people haven't really spoke about too much, Villaraigosa talked about this a lot, when he was campaigning. And, frankly, Bill, I'd love to hear your opinion. I'm surprised he didn't receive more support during the June primary. But he really talked a lot about trying to incentivize development in the Central Valley, which I thought makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, the ability that we're going to be able to really expand housing in San Francisco, in San Jose, in West Los Angeles is going to be limited. Whether we even if we deregulate, even if we limit NIMBYism, really pursuing housing outside of 30 miles within the Pacific Ocean, I think, is where we really have to go. Villaraigosa really pushed that. I don't know how much people listen to him, but I hope Newsom and the legislature think about that.
Right. So Antonio running against Gavin Newsom in the open primary in California system, it's the top two finishers who advance regardless of party affiliation. So that's what Villaraigosa was trying to do, finish second. This created there are a lot of strategic challenges for Villaraigosa in that primary, Lee, beginning with just how he was going to brand himself. Newsom had an enormous head start. Look, Newsom was elected lieutenant governor in 2010, and he basically started running for governor in 2011. So he had a 6 to 7 year head start on the man, which meant cornering a lot of money, not available to Antonio, getting a lot of endorsements, just working the state relentlessly and building a network. So Antonio was playing catch up, but it really was the identity issue, Lee, in that he had to figure, okay, am I just going to be a relentlessly pro-business Democrat, which is why he was getting a lot of money from the likes of Eli Broad and, you know, some very wealthy California Democrats, because they saw him as kind of the more sensible solution than Newsom on that front. Do I go to the Central Valley and just really try to play the Hispanic card and make myself more of an ethnic candidate? And he really could never quite figure how to get in there. And then the other problem is just simply incumbency. Newsom is lieutenant governor. Even though that job doesn't have a lot of clout, you don't do much, boy, it sounds good to voters. It sounds like you were Robin to Batman, that you were the governor's sidekick, the lieutenant governor. Wow, he must be important. Antonio was a former mayor of Los Angeles. And boy, Southern California, just people forget very fast. Something which is might come up in 2020. Let's run down the podcast here. Proposition 13, Lee. There is already an initiative which is qualified for the 2020 ballot, and it would go after the fabled 1978 Proposition 13, which imposed limits on property tax increases in California. It's a so-called split roll initiative, Lee, because it attacks the business side of Proposition 13, the taxes on business properties. I look at the Democrats in Sacramento, Lee, and it's like watching an otter trying to crack open a clamshell when it comes to Prop 13. They just want to tear into it and get the money out of it. And there's a lot of money at stake here. I've seen estimates at, what, $10, $12 billion a year if you do this. But here's the question, Lee. What happens if you do get into Prop 13 and What if it gets passed? We've passed tax increases here in 2012 and 2016, a tax decrease, repealing the gasoline tax increase. Looks like it's losing. In 2020, now you're going to gamble that Californians will yet again be pro-tax and they will go after Prop 13. What are the real consequences, though, if you do a split roll repeal?
Yeah, great question. Great question. And so many interesting sub-questions about that, including the fact that California is, you know, depending upon how you measure things, probably the fourth highest taxing state in the country. We have the highest tax rate on top earners. We have lost 10,000 businesses in the last 10 years because of taxation, because of high costs. So the question is, I love your description that the Democratic component of the legislature is like an otter trying to crack open an abalone shell. You know, they're scratching on their head. They're just not really sure how to do that.
Right.
They would love to do that. There's a sense in which, from an efficiency point of view, all things equal, taxing property is more efficient and less damaging to the economy, all things equal, than taxing income. And so I'm really focusing on the statement "all things equal," because in this state it won't be all things equal. There will not be a corresponding reduction of $10 or $12 billion in taxes coming if Prop 13 was split like that. I'm going to veer off what I specialize in, economics, into your world of politics. And I will think that that won't pass. And a big reason why is that an awful lot of money will be thrown against that and indicating, you know, somewhat rightfully, that increasing business costs beyond what already is perhaps the most expensive state in the country to do business will drive out more businesses, will reduce the number of good jobs, will hit voters, taxpayers, homeowners, in ways they don't want to be hit. So I think they'll still be the otter trying to figure out how to crack the abalone after the 2020 election.
So you just stole my thought. I was going to say that what is notable about a Prop 13 ballot fight, if indeed this happens in 2020, there's a school of thought that it's on the ballot just to force some sort of deal in 2019 in the legislature, but I'm not sure the lawmakers want to have their fingerprints on this. You will see the business community engage, Lee, in ways that it has not in California in a long time. What's notable about the two tax increases that Jerry Brown got done in this decade was that the business community was silent for the most part. And why?
Yeah.
Well, two reasons. Number one, it's like that Far Side cartoon of the two bears in the forest, and the one bear has a rifle scope sight on him, and he's pointing to the other bear to shoot him. That was kind of their attitude on the tax increase. That, okay, fine, if you're going to go after high-end earners, that's fine, but if you're not coming after businesses, we'll take a pass. But then there's also a very practical consideration, Lee, that Jerry Brown, you know, for 8 years has been there, very thin line of defense against the legislature. Each year, the California Chamber of Commerce puts out a series of bills job killer bills. I'm sorry, blanking on that. But it picks about 12 bills the legislature is doing and calls them job killers, they're bad on taxes, regulation, or so forth, and it prays that the governor vetoes them. Well, Jerry Brown's batting average on the job killers is pretty darn high. He usually goes about 2 for 3, 3 for 4 on them. They don't want to rattle his cage, so they've been pretty quiet for the most part, but I would pretty much safely predict here, getting back in the predictions game, if there's a run on Prop 13 on the business side, the business community has no choice but to engage, Lee, and they will just throw everything at it the way the CTA, the way the teachers union does in its death fights, and they'll spend $50 or $100 million to kill it. But here's the question, Lee. If Prop 13 were to be tinkered with, were to be revised, who walks in California? Do we see an exodus of businesses leaving California? But also, Lee, do we maybe see kind of a psychological breaking point of Californians? And this is the last question I think we'll do on this podcast. We go back to the 2003 recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and we tend to focus on Arnold running and the novelty of it, blah, blah, blah. But we forget that there are a couple of government actions that really kind of drove this thing in the first place. One was rolling blackouts. And the second one was the increase in the vehicle license fee, which, by the way, getting back to our Prop 6 conversation, Lee, I think this has been one of the problems with Proposition 6. Very easy to get people upset about the so-called car tax increase in 2003 because it was an average of about $158, I think, and it showed up in the mail and you had to look at it square in the face. And because you don't pay attention to Sacramento, you didn't realize it was being done. So it made you mad. Whereas a 12 cent a gallon gas increase, Lee, that's kind of like sort of the slow boil of the frog on top top of the stove, and that you may notice gas prices are up a little bit, but it's not the same as being asked to pay $158 once. So maybe that's a difference. But if you look at 2003, you have these government problems square in the voters' face, and it makes them mad, mad enough to boot a governor and bring in Arnold Schwarzenegger to go with the untested. But in 2018, California, 2020, California, Lee, what do you see as possible triggers to get Californians in that state of mind? And I'm not advocating recalling Governor Newsom. Let's give him a chance. But it really is the question of what's going to get voters angry enough to want to change the status quo. Because, look, this is a status quo election in California. We're bringing in another Democratic governor, all Democratic lawmakers. Nothing is changing. And it's nothing's changing in part because nothing is really registering with voters.
Bill, you're spot on so many dimensions there. People have to be upset. They have to get hit in their pocketbook, or they have to get hit with an important public policy opponent that's just so obviously failing, and obviously failing for reasons of policy. And I think a lot of California voters are getting close to that point. They're tired of having their cars wrecked by roads that aren't fixed. They're tired of underperforming schools. They're tired of water rationing during periods of drought. I think if we, we're going to have a situation that's very challenging. Almost 40% of our tax revenue is now going to Medicaid. That's going to continue to rise. Pensions are chewing up more and more of state and local budgets. That will continue to rise. We already are a very, very high tax state where we can't find the money to invest in basic services that Pat Brown and legislators had no problem finding in back in the 1950s and 1960s. So this is just going to get worse. And Newsom and Democratic majority in the legislature is going to have to look in the mirror and say, you know, D-Day is coming. We have to make changes that so voters do not completely blow up and say, hey, you know what, I'm mad as hell and I've had enough of this. And it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough just from healthcare costs and pension costs alone. Those both together will be a real challenge for the next governor and the next legislature.
So it sounds like you're telling me on election night to watch for the polls to close at 8 o'clock, wait for the elections to be called at 8:01, and at 8:02 go on Zillow and start looking at property in Salt Lake City.
So many have.
Okay. Leo Hanning, I enjoyed the conversation.
Bill, so much fun. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and in this instance, the 31st state in the Union, California. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, I encourage you to find California on Your Mind. Leo Hanian writes for it early in the week. I write for it later in the week. And while you're also on the Hoover site, don't forget to sign up for the Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Leo Hanian and his colleagues to your inbox every weekday. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Leo Hanian is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @Lee_Ohanian. That's LEE_OHANIAN. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @HooverWhalen. Whalen spelled WHALEN. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. Take care, and thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.